This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, originating from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Robin Dow is producing your number, 877-217-5757. Emails go to talk@talklouisiana.org. And before we start with our program, and Greg LaRose, one of the top reporters in our country who calls Louisiana home with the Louisiana Illuminator, I do want to note that Brian Pope, music host of Center Stage on WRKF now for 20 years, I know, because back in the day when I was station manager, that's when the program began on Sunday nights, and he was a exceptional man. He chaired over 30 musicals locally, appeared in a dozen musical productions, and was inducted into the Baton Rouge Little Theaters Hall of Fame in 2012. Well, Brian died over the weekend, one day short of his 75th birthday, and he was a man of great spirit, true force of nature, always enthusiastic about what he did and what others did in his orbit. And he retired from Dow Chemical Company, working there as a chemical engineer for 30 years, and that shows you how sometimes people who have jobs that may not be as glamorous as being on the radio, they have other talents, and Brian was a multi-talented man, and we will miss him, and we will keep you posted about arrangements as we say goodbye to one of the great voices of WRKF. Greg LaRose is with us, and I've known Greg for a few years, graduate of Louisiana State University, and back in the day he was a Capitol reporter for the Louisiana Radio Network, also was editor of Tiger Rag Magazine, and now he's editor of the Louisiana Illuminator, which is doing some remarkable work. And it's one of those online entities that is going places others are not, and that's what it's all about, finding stories no one else does. And Greg, as editor, opines about the world at large. And good morning to you, Greg. It's nice to hear your voice.
Same here, Jim. Thanks for the invitation. Good to hear from you.
Well, a couple of your editorials over the last few days, I think, are pertinent. Certainly, we have a governor who, as effusive as he is, and he has a great personality, he doesn't care for media scrutiny. He's not the first governor or president or public official to be in that group, but you went so far as to say that sunshine is desperately needed in Louisiana politics. I think some of us would say amen, but why do you think this is essential to the process of not only those covering what's going on, but those who rely upon the coverage?
Sure. So I think there's been no question since taking office, there has been a pattern from the Landry administration and the governor himself to place more and more of what typically is accessible to the public in terms of records, in terms of meetings that the public has had access to. The governor wants exceptions to that. And look, as a lifelong journalist, if there's one thing I've learned, that you know, no one really cares how hard it is for us to do our job. So please don't mistake this as, you know, I'm just beefing because my job got harder. I think the public has to have a more recognition that many of the things that they find important or need to know about what's happening around them, you know, we're not just talking about, you know, the proceedings of the legislature or, you know, the committee meetings that take place at the Capitol. This trickles down to every sense of, you know, economic development in terms of what, you know, might be being built across the street from your home or your business. There's just clearly an attempt that I see less and less access, and I'm hoping that the public takes note and makes it, you know, known to the people who represent them that, you know, this access is important. It's critical to a functioning democracy.
On another topic, our state treasurer, former Congressman John Fleming, who may very well be running for the U.S. Senate in 2026, he has recommended the state not do work with Bank of America as a fiscal agent because of the financial institutions' environmental, social, and governance principles. You say that this is impractical and it will cost the taxpayers money. Why?
So this is a big, it has been a big conservative push in recent years to essentially take shots at corporations and investment funds that are really just reacting to market pressures. There's a growing class of investors that wants to put their money into entities that are keeping in mind things like the environment, like social stances, whether that be, say, diversity, equity, inclusion. And again, this is just really the marketplace reacting to a growing class of investors that want this. So what you've seen from Fleming and from like-minded conservatives is that they I think automatically view this as anti-oil or anti-Second Amendment. And that's not necessarily always the case, but again, with the reaction to the market forces, the Wall Street and corporations want to have that option in there. And by, you know, establishing this, and you know, the Treasurer's just said it's a recommendation, has no real binding authority. He wants the state to no longer do business with Bank of America because it has made policy decisions based on some of these principles. Now, Bank of America's responded, essentially said, well, no, the Treasurer is reading a lot into this and just in some instances has his facts wrong. And that's more or less just been a back and forth finger pointing. But I thought the take from Jan Mohler of Invest in Louisiana was pretty insightful. Of course, his organization has the interests of taxpayers, the public, especially those who rely on government for a lot of support. And he noted that, you know, simply by taking this stance, one, it doesn't really lock Bank of America out of competing for the big money bonding issues in Louisiana. And if we're just strictly talking about removing it as a fiscal agent, then Jan makes the point that you've reduced competition and therefore there's, you know, that much pressure on the other competing banks to bring down interest rates and save the state money.
All right. Well, another story, and we will talk more about this tomorrow, Caitlin Joshua, who spoke at the Democratic National Convention last week in Chicago, will be with us. She, of course, has told her story many times, and she did so to the nation last week, was 11 weeks pregnant when she started miscarrying in the fall of 2022, a few months after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And she sought care at a couple of hospitals here in Baton Rouge and says she was turned away. Now, the Attorney General has pushed back on this, and now those two are going at it, and hopefully we'll have Liz Burrell on very soon as well, but... But your thoughts about this issue and how it applies in Louisiana.
So, yeah, the Attorney General, in essence, came out the day after Caitlin Joshua and the other women who told their stories of, you know, difficulties of obtaining reproductive health care. The Attorney General came out and just said basically, you know, quoting her now, Democrats have their facts wrong. And this was in a social media post. She proceeded to sort of lay out that the law does allow for physicians to offer emergency abortion care in instances, as the law dictates, when the life of the mother is in jeopardy or, you know, the condition threatens a vital organ of the person carrying the child. Well, you know, this is exactly the scenario that Caitlin Joshua describes, and at a hospital in Baton Rouge and one, I believe, in Prairieville, she was turned away, and for the reasons that when we've reached out to professionals in reproductive care, they've expressed serious concerns and, you know, questions about the specifics of the law. And, you know, it's since been noted, not just by Caitlin Joshua, but others, that when there was an opportunity in this past legislative session to bring some clarity to that law and spell out exactly what physicians and healthcare providers could and could not do, that was something the Attorney General, the governor, and anti-abortion lawmakers decided that, you know, they didn't want to add that clarity. So, yeah, it's been a pretty interesting back and forth. And
Well, you know, and this was when Jeff Landry was Attorney General, and when Caitlin had these issues in 2022. We'll spend a few more minutes with Greg LaRose and go to the phone lines after this. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with the editor of the Louisiana Illuminator, Greg LaRose, and you can go online and you'll find out things about Louisiana life and politics that you probably won't anywhere else if you go to Louisiana Illuminator. And he and his staff are doing fine work, and we've had Piper Hutchinson on a few times talking about higher education. But Greg is here with us for a few more moments, and tomorrow, as noted, Caitlin Joshua will be here with her sister, her twin sister, Angel Bradford, both of whom are activists, talking about politics. And, of course, Caitlin, she was center stage at the Democratic National Convention, and she got lots of airplay, and we will be talking about that. Robin says we'll take a call or two. Our time is limited with Greg, but David in Atlanta, I know you've been waiting longest. David, you're on. Please be brief. You're on with Greg LaRose.
Good morning, Mr. LaRose. In yesterday's New Orleans Advocate, Heather Cloud, a Republican state rep, introduced a bill to cut fees for truck permits, and she owns an interest in a trucking company. Isn't this typical Louisiana sleazy politics?
I'm not going to go so far as to place that label. I will note, however, in a little bit of a self-serving plug of my own, that we broke that story months ago. And, the Cloud family does have interest in trucking. Her defense to that was, you know, you have lawmakers in many lines of work, and they have sponsored laws. And, you know, one of the more interesting responses has been, well, you know, you've got a lot of lawyers in there, they're making laws, is that a conflict of interest? But, you know, to your point, it does raise eyebrows when a lawmaker does decide to pull together something favorable. And, you know, that's just again, I guess, you know, the things that we keep an eye on, that, you know, when it crosses the line to be so specific to have effect on an individual's holdings, definitely I think it's something that we need to bring to light.
We've got several questions, but here's one I didn't anticipate. But Reverend Alexis Anderson asks, Greg, what are your thoughts about candidates who choose not to debate and directly engage voters? And does this seem to be a growing trend?
Yeah, you know, I've got a commentary that should be coming out, if not today, then tomorrow. You know, I took the trip up to Alexandria to participate in the KALB TV's debate for the 6th District, much to my disappointment. Neither of the party-endorsed candidates, Cleo Fields or Albert Guillory, took part. And, you know, I think if you look at most prognostications, Fields has got a pretty easy path to victory here. But, yeah, I do see it as a trend, and it is concerning. I think, especially if you're part of this new 6th district, this was probably the only opportunity, you know, for this district-wide broadcast for you to get a feel for where these candidates stood and, you know, give them a chance to defend their platforms. You look at it, Jeff Landry pulled that off really well. It certainly didn't hurt his chances at claiming the governor's race last year. And certainly there's been selectivity among frontrunners not to do anything that would worsen their chances. But, yeah, I think voters end up paying the cost for that.
Well, Greg, let's talk again soon. Keep up your good work with the Louisiana Illuminator, the editor, Greg LaRose. Appreciate you.
Same here, Jim. Thank you.
You're welcome. John Ed Bradley is with us, the man who is a true Renaissance man. He, of course, has written some of the best novels of the last 30 years, Tupelo Nights, The Best There Ever Was, Smoke, and one of those is now 20 years old, and it's his favorite, and it's his passion. And we'll get to LSU football a little bit. LSU, by the way, a 4.5-point favorite in its opener against USC Sunday in Las Vegas. But 20 years ago, John Ed Bradley wrote about the art world, a novel, Restoration, and it's held up well. For those who are unfamiliar, when journalist Jack Charbonnet meets Reese Goudeau, a beautiful art restorer, he's soon caught up in intrigue more fascinating than any news story. And it is quite a read, and it is about things that go beyond the world of art, pre-World War II New Orleans. And good morning to you, sir. Always a pleasure to share the microphone with John Ed.
Good morning, Jim. Great to hear your voice. Thank you for that beautiful introduction. I appreciate it.
And through the years, I think you've evolved in which you get probably as much or more joy out of going to an art gallery than you do even Tiger Stadium. And you're the guy who wrote the definitive book, It Never Rains, in Tiger Stadium.
I love art galleries. I love museums. I love junk shops, thrift stores, consignment stores. I love auction houses. Wherever there's art, I want to be there. It's funny, I was writing about sports for the Washington Post and then Sports Illustrated, and whenever I traveled, if I had any downtime, I would find a local museum and visit. If I was driving along and saw a garage sale, I would pull over to see if they had any art. And I was, I would buy things. I was a obsessive collector. And, I think I have over 1,000 paintings, probably 500 pieces of pottery and sculpture. I have prints. It gets out of hand sometimes. In recent years, I've really put on the brakes. But about 30 years ago, 20 years ago, before I became a dad, before I got married, I was obsessively collecting art, most of it Louisiana pictures. And it's just been, a great joy for me. I love living with it, and it inspires me. I identify with the artist. I'm as much into the artist as I am the art. I'm a collector in a way of people. And it inspired me to write Restoration. I wrote another book called My Juliet, which is also set in the art world. And then in recent years, I've done some journalism about art.
You have?
Yeah, it's what I think about all the time. Mm-hmm. I think about art.
And a listener, and I'm pleased that this has inquired about something. I think this one was in Garden and Gone. You did a great profile about a guy named William Toy. Now, this guy was... I don't know if he's still with us. I think he's passed, but he was a great artist. But he also was a fraud, wasn't he?
He was. He was. He was a fascinating guy. I got to know him through the course of reporting a story about him. But he was. He hurt a lot of people. He defrauded innocent people, good people, friends of mine. But he was a very talented artist who made his way faking Clementine Hunter. Clementine Hunter was a folk artist from the Natchitoches area who is now regarded as one of the great African-American artists ever. And I love her work. And a buddy of mine from Baton Rouge, Don Fuson, who's a great collector, he told me about Toy. And I started to pursue the story. But it was fascinating to work on it. When I met him, he had been found out by the FBI. A special agent named Randy Deaton had done this incredible work pursuing Toy and really brought him down and convicted him. But I spent a lot of time with Toy. I felt sorry for him. He had a lot of his own work laying around. And I would buy it. I kept him going for a long time. So right now I have an attic filled with his work. I mean, big canvases, and some of it is really incredibly good. But he was, there was a I hate to say it, but there was an evil aspect to Toy. He lied with every breath he took. He was a liar. And, you know, in the end, he was just this really pathetic mm-hmm. creature. And I don't know. I thought I might write a book about Toy, but I just couldn't. I was too close to it, and I couldn't get any lift. I couldn't get it going. I still think about it. Maybe one day, you know, I'll do that.
Well, he had lots of cats, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He lived in a house filled with cats, and I'm a cat guy. I love cats. So I would go there, and, you know, I'd start petting one, and then I'd have 20. You know, 20 fighting for my affection. He had cats, and he had pulled up all the carpet and the wood in his house because they had, you know, done their business everywhere.
Oh, my goodness. We'll talk more with the great John Ed Bradley when we return on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and another segment with John Ed Bradley. He and I went to school at LSU at the same time, and in 1979, he was an all-conference center for the Fighting Tigers of Charlie McClendon and Coach Mack's last season. He wrote about his life and times, and much of it is related to his experience at LSU, and it never rains in Tiger Stadium. But John Ed's true passion, I believe, is in the art world, and he's traveled the world. Native of Opelousas, but he returned home, and he lives near New Orleans. And that city, for those who love art, it's a good place to be, isn't it, John Ed?
It is. It's a great place to be. You know, it's been the center of art activities in the South since the 1800s. There have always been great artists working there. And it's one reason why I wanted to move to New Orleans. First moved there, and I think it was 92 or 93. It was after I had, you know, my time at the Post, and I was writing for Esquire magazine and writing novels. And I just wanted to immerse myself in the art world. I had met an old artist named Edward Schoenberger. He was a WPA era artist in New Orleans, and I was fascinated by the guy. His nephew was a friend of mine, and he owned some of these 1930 period paintings, American scene paintings, and I loved them, you know, and I wanted to buy that kind of stuff. And so it introduced me to a world, and because I was working as a journalist, you know, as a reporter, I was curious about people, and I would mm-hmm. I would arrange to interview artists. Most, you know, I decided that there were, you know, some of these old timers like Schoenberger was still around. So I arranged to meet them, and I interviewed them at length. In some cases, I bought their work. You know, I would buy estates. I would buy like 50 works of art, and just to have it. And then I got to be friends with John Klimmer, and John was John's probably one of the great artists ever to come out of state Louisiana. He was born around Donaldsonville on a plantation. He moved to New Orleans as a young boy, and he just did remarkable modern work. He was a modernist, an abstract painter, and he became, in my adult life, probably my best friend. I was with him all the time. I would hang out in his studio, and he knew everybody. He knew all these artists, and we would have these little adventures, you know. We would go and meet different people. We would go to shows together, to galleries together. The Historic New Orleans Collection a few years ago did this remarkable exhibition of his work and other artists from that era. And a few of my paintings were in that show. But so it's just been this wonderful adventure for me. I'm grateful for it. I'm in awe of these people who give their lives to art. You know, Baton Rouge is another great art city. There are great collections there. There are great artists there. We live in an amazing state. I mean, just if you just look around, and I mean, I have such gratitude for where I grew up, and you know, who my family and their encouragement of these pursuits. Like, not many kids from Opelousas want to be novelists, you know, but they were always encouraging me. And so I don't know. It's just been this remarkable experience, and I'm grateful for it.
Well, you did it. And I said 30 years. It's now actually been, I think, more than 40 since Tupelo Nights. But John Ed Bradley got his first job out of college writing for the Washington Post, working for Ben Bradley, the Ben Bradley, and that propelled him to Esquire, Sports Illustrated, and he's held some of the top positions in American journalism, but he has the talent to back it up. But he appreciates other people's work, and a listener asked about whether art is a lucrative process, and if you invest right, you probably could do as well or better in the art world than you can in the stock market, John Ed.
Yeah, I always saw it that way. At first I just bought what I loved, you know, but then I was, now this goes back a long way, the late 80s into the 90s, when I was doing quite well financially, I was buying art, and I would spend, a lot of money on it. And I was always buying with an eye to the market, you know, what is this a good value? Will this be something that people like in the future? I was always looking for painters who were then obscure, maybe were academically trained, but had, for whatever reason, fallen out of favor or just they weren't happening anymore. And I would buy their work. And I was buying mid-century modern Louisiana art before most people were. I bought a lot of that. And and even now, I mean, I don't, when there's a struggle, you know, I'll pull a painting off the wall, and I hate to do it, but that's what, if I have a tax bill or whatever, you know, but it is a market, and it can be lucrative, and well, it's,
yeah. And I know you bought like a first edition Hemingway book when you were in your 20s and you did very well, but I bet letting go of that was painful.
It was. I used to collect books the way I collect art today. When I was younger, when I was with the Post, I didn't have a whole lot of friends when I got there. I didn't really know anybody. And I would go to bookstores, and I would take the train from Washington to Baltimore, and I'd hit the used bookshops, and then I would go to New York and shop there, and then I would come back late at night to D.C. And I would shop for rare first editions. And the thing about that is I educated myself. You know, I knew what people liked, what they wanted, what they would pay for. I bought a first edition copy of A Farewell to Arms by Hemingway, and it had a nice dust jacket. I found it in Maryland, and I paid $330 for it, and I think it was 1984. And that was a lot of money at the time for a book, you know. But I sold it for, I think I sold it for $5,000, and I used that money to buy art. You know, I would just turn around and buy paintings with it. But I had a big Hemingway collection. I had Faulkner, Catherine Ann Porter, Carson McCullers. I just had a passion for this stuff. You know, I was just a collector. It was in my bones. I had to go get these things, and I loved it. You know, I was always learning. I was reading a lot. And now I read, you know, I read art books, I read art criticism, biographies, and I can't get enough of it. You know, I just consume all this material.
Yeah. And you introduced me to a guy named Philip Thompson, and I'm looking at one of his great paintings of the Marigny Opera House in this studio. And he's one of those people, I'm sure, who will be revered much more after he passes than he has on this earth. But he's pretty good, isn't he?
He's great. Philip Thompson is a great artist. You know, he's Louisiana's Edward Hopper, and Edward Hopper is one of the great American artists ever. And Phil is that to the state. He, you know, he's academically trained. He went to the New Orleans Academy of Fine Arts and was educated there. But being an artist has just been in him, and he's. You know, he says he's not painting anymore. I'm trying to get him to paint again, but he's just terrific, you know, and it's wonderful to live with his work. I'm in an upstairs writing room right now, and I'm looking at a painting he did of the Louisiana Capitol, which is just magnificent. And, you know, I enjoy being with Phil. He has a small studio in Old Metairie. And I mean, I'm sure you love your paintings, Jim, because he, you know, I treasure what I have of his. He's not cheap, you know, you got to pay a little bit for him, but it's a small sacrifice. And his work just delivers, you know, it's just so inspiring.
It is. Well, you've inspired us first as a football player, and that shaped everything else, didn't it?
It did. You know, my dad was a high school coach, and I wanted to make him proud of me, and I played ball and then went from Opelousas High to LSU. And, you know, it was a dream for me to play for Coach Mack at LSU. And it still informs my life today. I mean, I can tell you, I never would have gotten that Washington Post job if not for LSU. I went up there to interview, and, you know, Ben Bradley wanted to know what it was like in Tiger Stadium, you know.
Isn't that something?
It's amazing. The sports editor, George Solomon, had he was a University of Florida grad,
right.
And he remembered me, you know. He remembered me from the Florida game. So it was an end for me, and, it's been a huge thing in my life. I never thought that all these many years later, I'd still be talking about it, but it's a source of great pride mm-hmm. for me.
Hal in Monroe asks, is it true that David Woodley was your roommate?
David and I were, we were teammates. We lived a few rooms down from one another. His roommate was Charles McDuff,
who
is also deceased.
Also
yeah,
died.
Who yeah. died. Charles was a great guy. He went to U High and Baton Rouge, big offensive tackle. But David and I were very good friends. We met during the recruiting, you know, time. I met him on a couple of trips, and we got along. He's a very bright guy, tremendous athlete. He was from Bird High in Shreveport, and we were really good friends, you know. And I wrote about him. I think it was 1982 when he was with the Dolphins, and he didn't like the story. He felt like I'd betrayed him. And he was upset about it. And I think he went to his grave being mad at me. I apologized to him several times. And these are things I wrote about in It Never Rains in Tiger Stadium. But I thought he was a really complex guy, you know, complicated guy. He was a tremendous player. We also had Steve Ensminger, who was a great player. And but David, he was
exceptional. John Ed, thank you so much. Let's do it again soon. Always a pleasure. This is Jim Inkster, Robin Dow producing, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, and we turn the page and head for the finish line with fascinating man, Peter Himmelman, former Rolling Stone editor Park Puterberg, wrote that Emmy and Grammy-nominated musician Peter Himmelman is on the same plane as Elvis Costello, Graham Parker, and Bruce Springsteen, and nudging his way to Dylanhood with over 25 critically acclaimed recordings to his credit. This singer-songwriter has been inspiring fans across the globe with his spiritually tinged Americana rock and roll for more than 40 years. He's the founder of Big Muse, a company that teaches creative thinking, leadership skills, and deeper levels of communication in all facets of life, from professional to personal. And then his clients include the Wharton School, UCLA, the United States Army War College, and international brands such as McDonald's, Adobe, and Gap. And he is with us. He has a book about his life called Suspended by No String, A Songwriter's Reflections on Faith, Aliveness, and Wonder. And good morning to you, Peter Himmelman.
Good morning, Jim. How you doing? Good to be back.
It's good to hear your voice. And you have some advice on simple ways to transcend the momentary sense that everything is dark and dire, and there's a lot of that out there now.
There it seems to be. I mean, it could just be part of it is the speed up of exchange of information, and people are hearing a lot more information that is dark and dire because generally it sells. And so, yeah. The book that I wrote isn't necessarily advice, but hopefully there's some inspiration to be gleaned in it, talking about, you know, how to create a state of mind that understands that beauty way outweighs, you know, infinite by infinite degrees, all the darkness that you just described, and how to sort of put yourself in that mindset.
Well, now we have, someone once told me, a wise man many years ago, we have more knowledge in our pocket, and he predicted this, than we have in libraries, and we are in a time of relentless information coming at us from all angles. Has this caused us to lose the ability to appreciate the mystical?
I think it certainly has. I mean, and knowledge, it's important, you know, for your listeners to understand, and I'm sure they do, does not necessarily equate to wisdom, the accumulation of just different, you know, bits of information does not lead a person to great understanding at all times. It's certainly a tool that helps. The overindulgence in this information, sort of swamped with it, definitely makes people nervous, anxious. It sells, as I said again, you know, the old journalistic idea was that if it bleeds, it leads. And as crass as that is, you see it meted out at all times.
The book from Peter Himmelman is Suspended by No String. And we're in a world right now in which we're fascinated with American politics. That may actually be a good thing, but of course we've got a new environment in that realm. Is that affecting the psyche of our country?
I think it is. You know, again, I have to say, there was a friend of mine who is a bit older than I am, and this is a couple of years back, and I was just mentioning how difficult it was, what a difficult time it was. And he was a Vietnam War veteran. He goes, you know, let me take you back to the 60s for comparison. There was literal, you know, revolution and bloodshed in the streets. I mean, it was, you know, cities were burning even more than they were in 2020. And it's maybe helpful to reflect on the fact that there have been these times in our national life that have been very, very difficult. And, you know, God willing, we'll be able to get over all of these things that are happening.
We're hearing the voice of Peter Himmelman, singer, songwriter, guitarist, film and television composer. Being an artistic person, does it perhaps make you and others like you more sensitive to the world at large?
Well, in some ways, I think that's, you know, sort of our job. Sometimes I'll write a song and somebody will say, that is such a wonderful articulation of the way I feel, which is to say that everybody feels alike. We all have these universal feelings. There's not that many of them. They're not thousands. There's basically, if you counted them, probably 10 general feelings. I think it's the job of the artist to sit with those feelings and make sense of them, or at least to write about them or draw them or write songs about them. It takes a certain amount of time to do that. And one of the things I've noticed with, quote, you know, creative people or artistic people that are successful is, while they're very diligent, they do take a lot of time just to read and to absorb information. And more importantly, is apropos of what we're discussing now, to process the information. And, you know, they're not academics, let's say, or intellectuals, but just this idea of sitting and thinking it through and coming up with either a response or an observation is a very helpful part of the task. And I think having a sensitive pair of antennae is very helpful in completing that task.
Again, an important book, Suspended by No String, from Peter Himmelman. Paul Reiser says Peter is one of the most talented, smartest, coolest cats I know. He says, I promise you, only goodwill will come from reading this. And Paul, of course, is a pretty exceptional guy in his own right. But you're a guy who has a life. You're not some guy who's just brooding off to the side. And a listener already has reminded me that you're married to a daughter of Maria, of Bob Dylan, and you have how many children?
I have four children and five grandsons, two of which were born in the last 3 weeks, so thank God for that.
Congratulations.
And you're right. Yeah, I do have a very, thankfully, a rich life, a rich creative life, and a very rich family life. For me, the family life always stood at the apex of that, if you call it the hierarchy of things that are of importance to me. Whereas music and so on wasn't, 9,004 or even 11. it sits at 2. So it's a really high place, but it's not one. One is reserved for family, for faith, and those kind of things that I think at the end of the day, everyone will decide for themselves, and likely that those were the most important things. Mm-hmm. As we live in this kind of mercurial world with, as you said, all this information coming at us, it's important to see, well, what is at the top? Where do you stand? What is the hierarchy of what is important to you?
And like Bob Dylan, you're from Minnesota, and there are some people who obviously know about you. They mentioned Sussman Lawrence. That was an indie rock band that our guest Peter Himmelman founded. But the music part of your life, it is a big part of it, and this is something I know that you have taken great pride in your work.
Well, yeah, I just, I enjoy it. Somebody asked me, I was so recently, I said, well, why do you keep doing this? And, just maybe your listeners don't know, but the idea that music literally, whatever lucre or whatever remuneration there was for music, it's very well diminished. It would be like any other job that's going away through AI or anything like that. Music is definitely the canary in the coal mine for that. And the answer that I gave, as I did just a little bit of thinking about it, why do I keep doing this? I keep doing it because it makes me feel good. And I got
the best reason of all.
Yeah, it's very simple. I got a letter from somebody yesterday, somebody from Israel, who had commented on something that I'd written and heard a few songs. And we got into kind of an email exchange, and he was so grateful that he had been inspired by something that I put out there in the world. And that is a kind of satisfaction that is very hard to describe, how much pleasure that brings to me.
Well, the book is Suspended by No String. Thank you, Peter Himmelman. Congrats on another fine work for this man who has many talents. And before we go, Robin Dow has a sampling of Peter as a musician and artist, and here we go.
With you, I can see specialize in the greed in this burnout city. With you, I can run from the shell shock demons dancing in my head. You give me strength when my legs are tired. You feed my soul when I'm uninspired. With you, I can speak in a voice that rings with love and mercy. I can stay.